From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll explore how one Wisconsin family's devastating experience with medical error became a beacon of hope and a call for reform.
The best thing that's happened is the film has turned into a call to action. That was not the intention. I just wanted to tell my mom's story. But now it's no longer our movie. It's the patients out there and their families.
Then two journalists talk about what it was like covering the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, and the impact of their reporting. And only 9% of all people in the STEM fields are people of color. One Milwaukee entrepreneur says that has to change.
The numbers, they are well known. And in fact, it's you can walk into a room, any classroom and see it, right? So it's obvious. But I think that it's time for us to not be okay with it.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Medical error is the third leading cause of death in America. Miscommunication between medical practitioners themselves and between them and their patients can lead to life-changing outcomes for those patients and their families. Stephen Burrow's experience is a case in point. In 2009, Burrow's mother, Judy, fell and went in for a routine partial hip replacement at the Aurora West Allis Medical Center. During the following months of painful recovery, she fell again. Then after 8 days in the hospital and a second hip surgery, where she lost a significant amount of blood, Judy fell into a coma that resulted in permanent brain damage. Stephen Burrows is a comedian and filmmaker by trade, but he was thrown headfirst into becoming an advocate for his mother. With advice from friends and lawyers, the Burrows family decided to sue Aurora for medical malpractice. Burrows filmed his mother and her pain levels to keep records for the legal trial to come, and that initial filming turned into material for his new documentary, Bleed Out. Stephen Burrows joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of Bleed Out's Wisconsin premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival this Saturday. He began by explaining why he decided to turn his mother's story into a documentary.
Well, this has been a 10-year process for us. When I started to film in the early days, I was actually told by our medical malpractice attorneys within the first few days that I needed to film her pain and suffering. I needed to make a record of that because no one else was going to do it. And that was, through this whole process, easily one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in my life is like stick a camera in my mom's face, especially back when we didn't even know if she was going to survive or pull through or coming out of that coma. So I was basically just documenting everything for the record because we had no idea where this thing was going. And then as I got deeper into this medical industrial complex siege and I started to find out how difficult it was to get accountability and transparency and how it was hard to even find an attorney to even take your case. And even the best cases lose 90% of the time. A friend of mine thought that maybe, you know, I should start thinking a little bit bigger and maybe not just make it just about my, I had basically three things: take care of my mother, pursue justice the only way we could was in the court system. And then the backup plan, the plan C, was maybe make a documentary at some point. We were definitely 3 or 4 years into the litigation when I started to see how unbelievably difficult it was going to be. And I started to find out that medical error was the third leading cause of death in America and all these other things that you see in the film that I didn't know anything about. And I thought maybe we might want to open this up a little bit because this personal story seems to be a universal one.
It wasn't until about 6 years after the initial events that the trial actually happened. So in the meantime, you are dealing with your mother's care, insurance companies, medical doctors, back and forth between Aurora, all of these things that people sometimes get thrown into. But I feel like a lot of times, unless it's an acute case such as yours and your mother's, but a lot of people will get those letters in the mail, the things from insurance, and they'll just want to get it paid and over with and toss it aside and move on. So what have you learned from taking a deep dive, and what would you encourage people to do to look a little more closely when it comes to looking at their own medical care? Because I feel like a lot of stuff just slips under the radar.
Right. Well, that used to be me. I didn't know anything about any of this. I didn't know anything about advocating for a person, you know, in the healthcare system. This was kind of, you know, my mom had made me power of attorney if anything ever happened. And we all, when we do those papers, we get the papers together, you know, we go, oh, it just nobody wants to talk about it because who wants to deal with that? But my mom actually did her papers just about 2 years prior to this. And we never thought we'd ever have to become, like, I'd have to become activated power of attorney. And then it hits you. Like, so what are you going to do with the one thing I would tell most people at this point is that, you know, we're all going to get sick. We're all going to have family members who are going to get sick. And we're all going to end up in the hospital at some point where our loved ones are. And what I learned is you need an advocate. You need someone who is your wingman, wingwoman, sidekick. Because when you're sick, you're not thinking straight. And you're scared and you're frightened. And you need someone like I literally write on my – I have a little list here. I always have my questions. And you will get better care regardless of the institution. You're going to get better care if you have someone who is asking the basic questions, and there are no stupid questions. You know, this is your life. And occasionally you're going to irk a very busy doctor or nurse because they're probably overwhelmed as well. But it doesn't matter, you know, because it's going to force them to think about what they're doing, how they're doing it. The other thing I learn now that I wish I would have known this. I could have avoided this whole thing is if I would have gotten a second opinion, like right away for my mom's hip surgery, the first hip surgery. If I just would have gone to just get a nice, clean, and what I've learned is that great doctors and nurses and hospitals, the reason I didn't do it is I didn't want to offend the doctor. I didn't want to make him mad or think I didn't trust him because we trust these caregivers, doctors, and hospitals blindly. I didn't do it. But I look back now and I go, that second opinion, there would have never been – we would have avoided this whole thing. And I would also say that I've learned that you actually – you know, it's tough to want to deal with this stuff. No one wants to, but I'm telling you, your life depends on it. And you got to start shopping. You know, we all shop for houses and cars and clothes, but we're not shopping for, you know, if you need your tonsils out, if you need to have appendix surgery or even a doctor's appointment. Like what doctors, what institutions are specializing in what's going on with you? I think that shopping, it's your life. And 10 years ago, I would have just, whatever.
Yeah. I'll get to it when it reaches a point where
exactly.
I can't stand it.
You can't wait.
Yeah.
Don't wait.
Mm-hmm. Our state legislature has made it more difficult for patients to fight against hospital negligence. So what is Wisconsin's place in this? And is it unique or is it just one example of a nationwide trend?
It's my understanding that the national trend is not good with this, patient safety. Every state has these organizations. And now we've been meeting people, especially the last 3 or 4 months, who are fighting in every one of their states for patient safety and patient rights. And like, can't we all, I mean, isn't this, shouldn't we all be on the, patient rights? Isn't that something we can all agree on? And there are laws in each state where that are set up that limit patients' rights. Wisconsin is one of the worst, without any question. One of the harshest. Even some of these laws, like the doctor privilege law or the I'm sorry law or the single person law, those are, even for these hardened pros who've been fighting for patients all these years, those laws shock the old pros. So it's bad here, real bad.
Another aspect to medical care that we all have to deal with is insurance companies. This film also shows just the widespread aspect of that medicine is corporate. It is a business, which in turn makes care impersonal. So do you think we're ultimately living with an inherently broken system if it's based off of business and policies and not about doctor-patient relationships at its core?
Right. Absolutely. In my experience, one should not – how do I say this? The size of your wallet should not determine the quality of the healthcare that you get. And I know that I've learned through the vast majority of hospitals and doctors and nurses that we've met through this process is they all want to do the right thing. You know, they want to spend more time with the patient. especially the doctors, you know, like an office visit. And a lot of these doctors only can spend 10 to 15 minutes with a patient. And what they want is they want to be able to spend as much time with the patient as they need. And what we found in interviewing like the Mayo Clinic, we went to the Mayo Clinic in the film, and their whole thing is patient safety. The patient is first, not the money. Regardless of their ability to pay, you come into the Mayo Clinic and facilities like that, they look at you and it's all about what can we do for this patient? It's not about how many hip surgeries can we crank out a day. It's what does that one particular person need that day? And it works, but there's this money incentive and, you know, the insurance companies, they win no matter what happens. Whether they pay or not, they're still making money, regardless of the outcome of any patient situation. It's like, who's going to, you know, I keep asking in our film, like, who is in charge of my mom's care? Which I still don't know.
10 years later.
10 years later. But who's in charge of healthcare? Like, somebody tell me.
Overall, yeah.
Right. I've been asking some of the brightest minds in patient safety, like, who's in charge of healthcare? And they're like, yeah, good question. That should frighten people. Scares me.
One thing that gave me pause was the whole aspect of telemedicine. So when your mother was moved to an ICU after her second hip surgery, there was a camera essentially watching over her in the corner that was linked to a remote care facility. You know, someone looking through monitors to check on patients versus a physical doctor right there with her post-surgery. And this is the focal point of what caused a lot of declining problems and long-term consequences. I wasn't even aware of telemedicine until this. So is this something that's very widespread, or was it just something that's being launched at several hospitals, or is it something that, again, is part of a system that's too big to fix or fail that is just a reality patients have to live with?
The telemedicine industry, especially this eICU thing, electronic ICU, is spreading like wildfire across the country. And I didn't know anything about it. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I was in the hospital with my mother after she was found in a coma. I actually found her in a coma. I was the person who noticed that something was wrong. She'd been there for 2 days in the ICU. And we found out about it by accident. Nobody at that facility told us anything about this. We wanted to meet with the doctor who was in charge of my mom's care in the ICU that night. And they said there wasn't a doctor there, that there was a camera doctor out by the airport. And that's all we knew. And then we started to investigate, and we went through litigation. We found out, at least in our case here in Wisconsin, that this electronic ICU camera, in my mom's case, replaces the bedside doctor in the intensive care unit. Now, there's great reasons to use telemedicine, but it does not replace the bedside doctor. And nobody knows about this. We didn't. And then we found out during our litigation, our trial, that this place, it's out by the airport on the corner of Grange and Howell. And that one facility, we found that there's one doctor every 8 hours watching 15 intensive care units, and they only have, like, I guess, 4 or 5 monitors. And in our case, they told me the camera was never on with my mother. So I'm like, well, I don't understand the point of this. And nobody knows about this. There was one doctor, our surgeon in our case, he claimed he never knew about it. And he was the surgeon. So if the surgeon didn't know, and if I didn't know, and you don't know 10 years later, I don't know what to tell you. That's one of the big reasons why we made this film, was when we found out about this electronic ICU, because I can tell you that critical care doctors across the country do not like this. You cannot.
Not in the most critical time of follow-up.
Yes, exactly. In intensive care, you cannot assess and manage a critical care patient through a camera that's not on.
There's a lot of questions about accountability, transparency. Now that we're 10 years down the road, I'm curious, have you heard anything from Aurora with this documentary?
Well, I have some breaking news for you. You're the first person to actually know this, because we never heard anything from Aurora. until about a month and a half after the film came out, which was earlier this year. And I got a letter from the CEO of Aurora, and it was a handwritten letter sent privately. It was not sent, you know, certified or anything like that. And it was not made public. He didn't, I don't know why they didn't share it with everyone, but it was kind of an apology, not a full-throated apology. They're sorry that, you know, this happened to our family and the American healthcare system. You know, it was a nice letter. You know, they sent thoughts and prayers at the end, and there was no offer of any transparency or accountability. It was just like kind of acknowledging the story, acknowledging the film, and, you know, it was nice. So I wrote right back, and I sent it back to a letter back to the CEO to see if we could. I thanked him for the letter and see if we could meet to, you know, talk about things. I thought it was the beginning of a dialogue, and we have not heard back. And that's been 6 months.
Are you hopeful that'll also be a call to action for systems like Aurora, for people studying medicine, for people already employed in medicine?
Yes. One of the best things that's happened through this disaster has been, you know, when the film came out, we were so fortunate to get the response was just really very encouraging. But then the public got hold of it. You know, HBO and their tentacles of, you know, millions of people then saw this movie. And then we started winning a couple pretty important awards. We won the Los Angeles Press Club for Best Documentary. And then the non-for-profit organizations, healthcare organizations, started getting hold of this thing. The Leapfrog Group, the Patient Safety Movement, the Global Neurosciences Institute. These are like incredible organizations who had been doing this for years, who never had, you know, they have the story, they have the stats, they have the white papers, they have the research, but they've never seen, you know, it's different when you can feel it. I could have told you our story, but when we show it, when you see it, it's different. It's more powerful and it's more urgent. And that's what they're telling me. And then the next step is now universities and medical schools and nursing schools are making this a part of their curriculum to teach their medical students and residents and nursing students, because it's a 10-year kind of epic journey, and this really happened in America, and we all make mistakes. You know, we're all humans, including doctors. Doctors are heroes, but things happen. It's not always negligence either. It's, you know, just sometimes things happen. The question is, when the mistakes are made, what are you going to do? And the best thing that's happened is the film has turned into a call to action. That was not the intention. I just wanted to tell my mom's story. But now it's no longer our movie. It's the patients out there and their families, and the fact that the medical community is embracing this film and using it as a teaching tool is the now my mom's legacy. That's her legacy, that all of her, everything she went through, you know, I'm haunted by her pain and suffering to this day. People ask me if this has been a cathartic experience or it's been a healing experience for me somehow. If I found peace, no, but I can tell you that my mom's story is helping people get better care. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that.
Along those lines, you know, on one hand, you come at this from a filmmaker and having done this for your career before the events with your mom happened. But it's also so emotionally entangling. You know, even before you decided to start making the documentary, you are spending time flying back and forth from LA to Milwaukee, dealing with insurance companies, dealing with hospitals, dealing with care, dealing with worrying about money, about your mom's money that had to go towards this. And now that you're in this stage and it's after this film is done and reaching audiences, how have you tried to continue to take care of yourself on a base level? Because it is hard when you do get wrapped up, deep dive into an acute case that many people, you know, would fathom to try and even begin to understand. So how have you tried to, I mean, it's not really possible to center yourself per se, but to shift your motivations throughout, to feed yourself and to try and keep it going?
Well, it's I can't lie. It's been tough at times. I think one advantage, I have a few advantages that a lot of these families that we've heard from, you know, over 5,000 other strangers and their families and their stories. And, you know, a lot of people can never do this. 10 years ago, we didn't know how long this was going to go. We didn't know if my mom was going to survive. We didn't know if she was going to be a long-term patient or a short-term patient. We didn't know how damaged she was going to be. So we kind of took it one day at a time, one week at a time. Next thing you know, it's months. Next thing you know, it's years. And it was always take care of mom first, get her day in court, and then maybe we'll do plan C. And then, as you saw, plan C became plan B. And plan A is still take care of mom. But if I wasn't in show business, if I had it like a 9-to-5, I could have never done any of this. If I didn't have a wife who was 100% supportive of this, because you keep saying deep dive, it's like, yeah. I mean, I kind of, I would say to my wife every once in a while, am I like kind of like Ted Kaczynski now? Am I out in the woods in a cabin going crazy? This thing has obsessed me. There's no doubt about it. And I'm only coming out of, I would say the one really good thing about the film is because the film is now done. You know, our lawsuit is done. Our film is done. So there is like the dust has settled and I do see light, and mostly from these medical institutions who are using the film, I see real hope. And that's helping heal me a little bit. But I have not, I can't say, I mean, I've, without my wife, without my family and friends, and without my aunt, who really was a big believer in this, couldn't have done it. So, but I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. No one's ever asked me that before. I'm not sure. I just keep going. I don't look back. Maybe I do look back. I'm looking back and in the present and in the future. I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, continue whatever you're doing, because this film is very impactful, and I know its reach will go far beyond the screening here at the festival as well. And Steve Burrows, I want to thank you for your work, for the work you continue to do.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here. It's a real privilege. Thank you.
Wisconsin native Steve Burrows is a writer, actor, and director. His latest documentary, Bleed Out, is making its big screen debut at the Milwaukee Film Festival this Saturday at the Oriental Theater. There'll be a panel to follow. And for more information on the film and on medical error in the United States, you can go to WUWM.com. Coming up next, we're joined by two of the journalists who covered the school shooting in Parkland, Florida. They'll discuss the impact of their work on their community and the country. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. The name Parkland, like so many other American cities, has become synonymous with school shootings. But in many ways, Parkland was different from those that had come before it. While students and families were in shock, they were also angry, they were activated, and they took action. Reporting on the event continued long after the national news networks had left Broward County. And the work of activists and journalists who continued to investigate what happened led to real change. This year, journalists at the South Florida Sun-Sentinel were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. Brittany Wallman and Randy Roguski were both members of that team, and they were in Milwaukee for Marquette University's annual Burleigh Media Ethics Lecture. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explained what their experience was like with this kind of reporting before Parkland.
We had had a mass shooting at the airport in Broward County, so that was not too long before the Parkland shooting. So we actually had some recent experience with it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the most similar event. You know, gun violence is part of a lot of what we do now. We're a pretty large population area, and we're reporting on gun crime a lot, but certainly nothing like this.
Yeah, what made this
different from things you'd seen in the past?
We had never had a school shooting, for sure. And so as soon as there were reports that there might be a school shooting, everybody was tuned right in. And the whole newsroom, you know, we're used to covering big events, like hurricanes, that require the entire staff. But in this case, you know, everyone from sports to features to Metro, everybody just sort of self-assigned and jumped on this story because it was ticking across CNN and Vox and MSNBC, and, you know, we could see that it was going to be a big deal.
You know, for someone like me who works in journalism but works in kind of a very different part of it, I don't work in breaking news, these stories always seem so daunting, both physically and emotionally. As those first moments are really playing out, what is that like?
You know, I think when these happen, this happened at the airport too, when they first happen, you just sort of hope it's not going to be the scale it is. And then as it starts to evolve, this newsroom in particular, I think, just rallies. I mean, it really, everybody just pitched in and wanted to do whatever they could to help report this story. It involved the entire staff, every single person on the story for a while, you know, for a number of weeks, because it was so competitive. I mean, there were media from all over the world just streaming into town to cover this thing.
It was very sad to cover. I mean, you know, as journalists, we're supposed to be detached and neutral, but we were just immersed in so much sadness and the community's grief. And one of the things that really helped was other newsrooms sent us food and, you know, one newsroom, you know, somewhere else in the country paid a bar tab for us. And, you know, because we were there from morning till night, and it was just so, that really helped a lot. It was, you know.
That was Las Vegas, wasn't it?
That sent us
yeah.
the bar tab.
I mean, there's this, unfortunately, this club of newsrooms. And then when it happens to another newsroom, then you sort of pay it forward.
Yeah.
And we did the same for other newsrooms that ended up having shootings.
It's terrible. One day the therapy dogs came in, and we needed it, you know, because this was a story that we knew that we were going to have to live with for a long time. We're still covering it. And, you know, we see the profound impacts of it on our social media every day, you know, parents posting photos of their dead children and that sort of thing. So just, and then of course there were people that, you know, I have a daughter that goes to high school in Broward, and other people had friends that lived in Parkland or went to that school. So initially it was just, it reminded me of, you know, on a much smaller scale, of course, but after 9/11, how every day you watch TV and you're just in tears and like, oh, this is heart-wrenching. And it was like that.
In that same vein, a lot of what journalists have to do in these moments is talk to people who have just gone through the worst trauma of their lives. How do you navigate that, especially when you're dealing with not just people who have gone through a huge amount of trauma, but children?
Well, this was sort of unusual in that, you know, so many people that were directly impacted by this channeled their grief into activism. And so, you know, that gave us a different direction to head in with some of these parents. But I still think about, you know, some of the people that, you know, there are the ones that we're all familiar with now. But, you know, what about the wife that we've almost never seen, or the dad that isn't on TV all the time, or the siblings? You know, there are so many. We went to funerals and talked to a lot of people that just didn't even know how to deal with their grief at the time. I don't know. It's hard. It's a difficult. Never gets any easier. I don't know what the right answer is on how you approach something that sad, because it's not just their own child that they've lost. It's part of this huge, terrible tragedy where 17 people died.
I think that's a good point about the activism and also about the response to trying to get answers to what went wrong in this, that there wasn't as much reluctance to talk to us is what you might expect in a lot of cases like this. And, you know, most of the funerals even were open to the public. There were a couple of them. They asked us, you know, to keep our distance, which, of course, we did. But for the most part, it wasn't banging on doors where people didn't want to talk to you.
That's true. And, you know, that reminds me, the school district put out something early on urging the media to basically not bother the families. And that was so incorrect because in this case, they had something to say and they were happy to have us paying attention. They still are. They've been some of our biggest supporters.
Yeah, the people that didn't want to speak to us were public officials.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like there may have been a reason for that.
Right.
Yes.
So much of your work was really looking at what went wrong before so much went wrong. And you dug into a lot of different things. You know, your work found systemic failures on the part of the school, social workers, law enforcement. What happened in the case of the school? Can you unpack that a bit?
Oh, my. Where do you start? You know, this particular kid had tremendous problems in the school district. And I think the more that Brittany and our other reporters dug, they found more and more of that. So some of it involved the school district mishandling this particular troubled kid. But there were other things where security wasn't handled well. And we found examples where school districts really all over the state were not reporting to the state the crimes that were occurring on campus. So there was a whole scope of things that had been done wrong that we were able to bring out.
That they didn't want us to bring out. You know, the school district really fought. They still haven't changed at all.
No, they have not changed. And they, at the very beginning, just the first days, they stated, we are not going to release any documents whatsoever related to Parkland, which is clearly a violation of open records laws in Florida. But that was sort of their tact from the very beginning, is we're going to just recluse into our shell, and that way you'll never find out the truth.
They really became, they were just instantly defensive rather than saying, you know, okay, we want to know what went wrong also, because we want to prevent something like this from happening again. Nicholas Cruz is not the only child like that in the Broward school system or in any other school district. So it really just always boggled my mind why they seemed to take it so personally that we were doing our job.
Well, and it seems like there had been a lot of warning signs beforehand that were just kind of, you know, put under the table and not thought about. But it is always distressing when you have a school district that's just gone through, I mean, a catastrophic event, and their initial reaction is, well, let's not think too much about it.
Yeah, it doesn't give you confidence as a parent. And, you know, we've heard from a lot of parents that are concerned, because if you have the school district saying, well, there's nothing to see here, boy, that terrible Sun Sentinel is just trying to, you know, make us look bad. Everybody knows that that's not the case. You know, it's a big school district, and, you know, of course they're not perfect. And when you have a troubled child like this, it's hard to educate somebody that has mental issues and learning disabilities. You know, they didn't get it right in this case, but we thought that it was important to really dig into the details and figure out, well, what does getting it right look like?
Well, and the attitude of the Broward County School Board may not have changed, but a lot has changed as a result of your reporting. What was its impact on the community? I mean, you did so many pieces, so I know this is a little unwieldy, but what was that impact?
Well, yeah, one of the stories that we did at the end of the year was, you know, we convened and said, well, we want to be productive. You know, we didn't want to just write stories just to write stories, and so we just tried to tick through a list of all of the things that have been changed to prevent another school shooting and what was left undone. And it is hard to wrap your arms around it, but there were changes in gun access to guns, the ability of law enforcement to take guns away from somebody who seems like they might be dangerous. That's huge. The the extreme risk protection orders that are now being discussed in Congress. The sheriff was removed and replaced with a different sheriff. There certainly, I would say, there was so much focus on the fact that deputies did not run in to try to save children that just in law enforcement, I think it's now clear that that is what the public expects. And there's been a lot of discussion and work in mental health. What do we need to do in the schools to provide services for kids that are not, you know, mentally healthy?
Yeah, and I think at this case even, you know, the legislature took a lot of action. The age to buy a gun in Florida was increased. There were a lot of requirements put on schools to have more armed security on campus. But it even went beyond that because one of the stories we did found that the FBI had dismissed two tips about this person. So we looked at how does that happen? You know, the FBI is supposed to be protecting everyone in the country. And the FBI made changes as well in the way that they hire people and evaluate them as a result of what went wrong in this case.
Now, this is a much more kind of technical question, but, you know, something you mentioned at the beginning, which I think is true for most of these situations, the national news, the international news in some cases really descended on your area, which is your beat, your community, the place that you are not only reporting on but also a member of. What is your advice for other newsrooms, other news organizations who experience a similar kind of situation where there's all of this national press, all of these people who are talking about your community? Where do you fit into that?
I think you have to be clear about what it is you want to accomplish. You know, the national media was largely focused on these Douglas kids who had become advocates for registering voters and young people voting and gun control and things. They focused on them quite a bit. They focused a lot on the gun issues. We felt, as a local newsroom, that there were important things like we were just discussing about what went wrong here and what needs to be improved and how can we keep this from happening again. That when you ask what advice would I give another newsroom, that's what it is that pick what your focus is going to be, decide what is most important for your community, and, you know, don't just flow with the river the way it goes.
And initially, you know, of course, it made it difficult for us to get our calls returned because someone, you know, would say, well, I have to call back the New York Times and or go on national television. And
particularly the kids, these kids, these high school kids were courted by the national media. And you know, if CNN's calling, you're probably going to call them back and not the Sun Sentinel.
But we reminded people, you know, they're going to leave town and we are going to be here to tell your story for as long as it takes. And so, you know, we just really nurtured relationships with sources and with, you know, people impacted and tried to not get swept up in the current, as he's talking about, with what national media was focused on. And eventually they did, you know, go away.
I mean, we had a conscious decision one day about how much effort do we want to put into the whole gun debate, because we could do things like we did that could actually have an effect, or you can rehash the gun debate, which is never going to change, and, you know, what better served our readers. And I think the path we took was more beneficial to our community.
Brittany Wallman is an investigative reporter, and Randy Roguski is the Metro editor at the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. They were both part of the team of journalists who covered the aftermath of the mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. The team received the Pulitzer Prize for public service for their work. Wallman and Roguski spoke with Lake Effect's Troy Powers while they were in Milwaukee for Marquette University's annual Burleigh Media Ethics Lecture. We'll take one last break, and then coming up, we'll look at a local initiative that's putting a focus on diversity in STEM fields. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The STEM fields, also known as science, technology, engineering, and math, have a diversity problem. Far too few women and people of color work in them. But a local initiative is hoping to change what the tech industry looks like, at least in Milwaukee. The Milky Way Tech Initiative is one program under the umbrella company Jet Constellations that Nadia Johnson started nearly 2 years ago. The initiative recently partnered with American Family Insurance Institute for Corporate and Social Impact, both to build new startups and to drive diversity and inclusion in the Southeast Wisconsin tech scene. Johnson recently spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell.
So we talk about the need for more diversity in the STEM fields, and I was able to find some data from the Pew Research Center, 2014 to 2016 data, but it says in STEM jobs, Black people make up only 9% of those jobs, Hispanics 7%, Asians 13%, and white people 69%. What do you think when you see those numbers?
So I think it's alarming. It is. It's alarming. And it's something that can be addressed. It's not rocket science, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're not trying to find water on Mars here. And I think that what's required in order to address these issues and to bring about equitable opportunities, I think, is to consult and reach out to the right people. Mm-hmm. I think that there's powerful entities that don't know how to address this issue. And they hire and fire people and trying to figure out what's the right solution. And really, I think that it's important for these organizations to know that you have to empower the right individuals. And so there are folks who know how to bridge the gaps. And it's just a matter of trusting and partnering with organizations that know how to address these issues to bring about the change that we want to see. I think that the numbers that you just shared, they are well known. And in fact, it's you can walk into a room, any classroom, and see it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's obvious. But I think that it's time for us to not be okay with it. Right. And that's one thing that, you know, I can say that there are certain organizations here in Milwaukee who are not OK with it and are willing to partner with the right institutions, organizations to make the change. And for those that I have witnessed that seemingly are OK with the numbers and I have, I think it's a matter of educating these organizations on why this is an actual issue. Right, in that this is not necessarily by choice of Black people or what they call minorities. This is just what we call a symptom of systemic oppression, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is a result of that, right? You don't know what you don't know. And the fact of the matter is it's also alarming to me because this is the tech, STEM is the future. It's not going to go away and it's the future. And so if we, you know, Black people... women, we are not a part of the conversation, it's going to have lasting impacts on our populations economically, for sure, right? Because mm-hmm. it's going to be difficult for us to get certain jobs, and most of these jobs are going to be heavily dependent on having these skills. And it's also just, it's going to be, it's going to impact our world in general. Right? We've got artificial intelligence and machine learning models being built by a certain group of people, as you just shared those numbers, right? So if these groups of people have certain mindsets, certain biases, it's going to be built into the programming, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to have machine learning models that are currently being built right now at this moment that's going to help determine whether or not you get a house, you get the credit mm-hmm. card. Right. And so if these machine learning models don't have certain perspectives, our perspectives, You can imagine how that's going to impact us in the future. So it's necessary that we are part of this, right? And so we have to educate organizations who don't understand it just yet on why it's necessary. And we have to hold them accountable as well. And so that's one of the things that I'm hoping to do with the Milky Way Tech Hub is if you're not partnering with the Milky Way Tech Hub and if you're not making sure that you're a part of this drive for diversity in Milwaukee's ecosystem, what are you doing and why not? And in that way, we're holding people accountable.
So the Milky Way Tech Hub is an initiative under the umbrella company Jet Constellations that you founded. For those who aren't familiar, explain a bit more about what Jet Constellations does.
So Jet Constellations was initially formed to address the lack of diversity in Milwaukee's tech ecosystem. It has evolved into a software company that builds out internal software and custom software for our clients. A lot of the internal software that we're developing right now and raising funds for are around the insurer tech space. Our target demographic, while we are welcoming to all brilliant minds, is the urban community, right? Making sure that we are providing resources so that they can take their brilliant ideas to the next level. So what we've learned is that the gap that currently exists is individuals are typically in underrepresented populations have brilliant ideas, but don't necessarily know how to take it to the next level in getting funding, getting teams together, and actually building out a product. And so while we are a software company, we also function as an incubator of sorts and taking ideas that people have and empowering them to be not just the folks that have the great ideas, but the folks who are the CEOs and founders of their own tech companies as well. And so you know, functioning as a software company, that's really how we make our money. but again, we also aim to make a social impact, right? And that's how the Milky Way Tech Hub initiative was birthed. And so the overall function of the Milky Way Tech Hub initiative is to promote STEM education throughout underrepresented, underestimated communities, build strategic partnerships with organizations that are like-minded and very much invested in seeing our mission be brought to life, and also empowering, again, underestimated, underrepresented Black people, women, to be founders and CEOs of their own tech company.
And so earlier in the summer, the Milky Way Tech Hub partnered with American Family Insurance Institute for Corporate and Social Impact. Talk a little bit more about how that came together.
Yeah. So by the time AmFam landed here, they made it very known that they were pushing diversity in tech and STEM. The Milky Way Tech Hub had started to, the wheels were already moving. And so we had created a community, and that's still currently growing and expanding, which I'm grateful for. And I believe that they just heard the buzz of the Milky Way Tech Hub. And so they reached out to me, and we sat down, had some coffee. I talked to them about the mission, and they were thrilled to hear that we existed. And the mission was carrying a lot of momentum and making some immediate impact in the city, and they wanted to be a part of it. And I think that one thing that's really important that I've noticed about AmFam Institute, aside from other organizations that I've worked with thus far, is that they, in their mindset, they were very much partnership oriented and not just sponsorship. So there are certain folks who, oh, you're doing something for diversity, here's some money, or here's your money for your event. And they're very much, we want to create a long-term partnership to see this through, to make this actually happen. And so they're working alongside Jet Constellations in the Milky Way, and that's extremely powerful. And then the sort of corporate citizenship that's necessary in order to make the sort of drastic change that we're aiming for.
And what do you see this partnership offering to Milwaukee in the long term?
Yeah, great question. So the goal of the Milky Way Tech Hub in general is to make Milwaukee known as a place where Black people, women, and people who fall under that whole underestimated and underrepresented category can come and thrive in tech. And there are not many places where, that actually exist. And so in order to create that sort of ecosystem, it requires strategic partnerships. It requires capital, right? It requires resources, right? Mm-hmm. Not just any resources, but resources that understand the need for diversity in the tech space and want to do whatever is necessary to bring about that change. And so the partnership with AmFam Institute, the goal is to leverage whatever resources that they can provide to bring this mission to life. So our first venture is to encourage and empower the startup ecosystem, specifically those with diverse backgrounds, to begin to see themselves as CEOs and founders of their own tech company. And right now we are together. Our first venture will be November 16th. We're hosting Milky Way Tech for Good Pitch Out, which is encouraging communities to come together, think of some great ideas on how they can support Milwaukee leveraging technology, and start your own startup, create your own product, pitch it out November 16th, and you may be awarded up to $10,000. So the goal with American Family is just empowering the startup community and making sure that diversity is a priority.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by The Doman Company.
Nadia Johnson is the CEO of Jet Constellation. She spoke with WUWM's Taryn Powell. There's more information on Jet Constellations and the Milky Way Tech Hub at WUWM.com. And the company will also participate in Startup Milwaukee Week, which begins on November 11th. And that wraps up today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for being with us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.